Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring, and we need to remind you of the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Dr. Boyd Haley, who's a professor of chemistry back at the University of Kentucky, and we've had him on in the past, and we're pleased to have him on again. And we're going to be talking about mercury and Alzheimer's disease. You know, Alzheimer's disease is something that, well, it used to be very, very uncommon, but it's increasingly common today. And not only that, but certainly it is the seventh largest cause of death in the United States today. And we have to ask why Alzheimer's disease is increasing so dramatically, and of course, what can be done? Certainly I know some of my friends, some of the doctors I practice with, who are totally disabled, having to be put in institutions. Some of the writers, a good friend, a gentleman who's written extensively on what's going on in the world, wrote The Secret History of Money and The Secret History, really going to the background of what's happening politically, and he really can't even remember that his wife has died. A tragic, tragic situation. Well, anyway, of course, Dr. Haley has been working for some time trying to analyze, of course, the relationship between mercury and Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Haley, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, why don't you just give us the background of how did you get interested? Because certainly as a chemist, what caused you to want to get in working on the relationship between mercury and Alzheimer's disease?
You know, it wasn't a plan I had. I moved from the University of Wyoming to the University of Kentucky because they had a medical center, because I had developed a technology that was very good at, you know, determining the some basic differences between normal tissues and diseased tissues. And then I had a graduate student who left my laboratory when they finished their PhD and went to work for an aging center. And they came back and was talking to me about the problem with Alzheimer's disease. And so we decided to use our technology to study this. And to make a long story short, we found differences between Alzheimer's disease and normal disease that no one disagrees with. Everyone will say we're right. Three major differences in biochemical entities that are important. And then we started searching for what could cause this, because Alzheimer's is not genetically inherited. It is it may be a susceptibility, but it requires a toxic insult. And what we found was that mercury, and only mercury, would mimic the biochemical abnormalities that you see in an AD brain if you added it to a normal brain. So we could take a normal brain, human brain, and add mercury to it and get the same biochemical abnormalities. Or you could take a rat and have it breathe mercury vapor, and again find these major abnormalities in the rat brain if it was exposed to mercury. And we published that, and that's when I got on the wrong side of, I would say, the medical establishment, because no one wants to believe that it is a toxic insult that's causing this disease, because then you don't have to have, all you have to do is end the toxic insult, but you don't have any drugs to sell. And that is basically how I got into it.
All right. Well, I'm glad you did get into it. And I think it's important that people understand that we're exposed to mercury all the time. We're exposed to the mercury in our fillings. We're exposed to mercury if we're downwind from a plant that is burning coal. There's mercury put out by coal. And certainly we are exposed to mercury in much of the fish we eat. But of course, one of the biggest sources of mercury for the elderly is what the CDC insists that we get, and that is our immunization shots that have thimerosal in it, toxic amounts of it, and there's a definite relationship, and they know that, and they still keep insisting the elderly be vaccinated. Well, why don't you pick up the story there, Dr. Haley?
Well, the bottom line is, when I found this out, I was invited to give some talks at, you know, with a group called the International Academy of Oral and Medical Toxicology. And this is a group of dentists and physicians and scientists who think that mercury shouldn't be placed in amalgam fillings. And this is really the sorriest part of the story, is that when I was first introduced to the fact that mercury came out of dental amalgams, I didn't believe it. I told my people, I said, no, the FDA and the ADA wouldn't allow this to happen. You can't have that much mercury coming out of amalgams. It would just be too toxic. So, but I did my own research. And just recently, Stan, that, you know, I mean, it was funded by the IAOMT, but we sent 9 molds that would hold a single spill amalgam filling to 9 different dentists across the United States and had them make 10 amalgam fillings each. And we take those amalgam fillings after they stopped, when they start leveling off, you know, for the amount of mercury, because they put off a tremendous amount of mercury when they're freshly made. But we waited until they became level, and then we measured the amount of mercury that came out of those amalgam fillings every day for 28 days, and it stayed consistently level across the 28 days. And what the important thing is that the audience, your audience ought to listen to, is that the amount of mercury just sitting in water, distilled water at room temperature, no abrasion, no heat, put off hundreds of times more mercury than what the ADA estimates. Now, this is the critical thing. That whole study cost less than $5,000, and yet the Food and Drug Administration and the American Dental Association refused to do that simple study. Instead, they estimate the amount of mercury coming off of amalgam fillings by counting the fillings in the mouth and then measuring the amount that's excreted in the urine. There's two important things wrong with that. First, less than 10% of the mercury that's excreted from your body comes out in the urine. The bulk of it, the huge bulk of it, goes out in the fecal material. And the second thing is, if you look at the latest studies that the National Institutes of Dental Research funded and supported, it showed that children who had amalgam fillings lost their ability to excrete the mercury after having it in their mouth 7 years. And the interesting thing was, the girls were much better at continuing to excrete the mercury. However, the boys, at the end of 7 years, were excreting no more mercury than the people who got composite fillings, indicating that they have lost their ability to excrete mercury through their kidneys as the longer they're exposed to the mercury.
And, of course, and some of them, of course, have it accumulating in the brain, don't they?
Oh, there's no doubt. Mercury vapor is what we, in chemistry we would call it a hydrophobic gas. In other words,
hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Haley was just talking about how he got involved in this whole issue of mercury, and of course discovered that there is mercury in the dental fillings, and the mercury in those dental fillings continues giving off. Now, initially, when you put the fillings in the mouth, why, there's a great deal of mercury, but after a while, why, it gets down to just a constant level, and it continues that as long as those mercury fillings are in. And it gives it off in a gaseous form, and they've actually done scientific studies to prove that the amount of mercury that's coming off is known to be toxic many, many, many more times than either the American Dental Association or the government agencies will admit. And, of course, this is poisoning people. And whether we're poisoning the children with the fillings, dental fillings, or the elderly with the dental fillings, mercury is one of the most toxic substances known to men. And Dr. Haley, because he's been speaking up out against this, is, well, he's come under a great deal of criticism. But anybody who tells the truth today about the cause of Alzheimer's disease is going to come under criticism. And you have to ask yourself why, when this is the 7th largest killer in America today. Well, anyway, Dr. Haley, certainly you've shown that the fillings continue giving off mercury. In fact, isn't there a website where our listeners could go to and actually see the smoking tooth?
Oh, yes, yes. It's called www.iaomt.org. That stands for the International Academy of Oral and Medical Toxicology. And also on that thing, there's several articles on mercury. And the one thing that, that our government just absolutely refused to reflect upon, and that's on the studies on cadavers, individuals that have died, say, in automobile wrecks, etc., when they can take samples of these people and correlate it, most of the bulk of the mercury, over 80 to 90% of the mercury in the human body comes from dental amalgams, not from eating fish or not from breathing the air, but from dental amalgams. There's no doubt about that. And this work has been done, you know, not only in California, but in Turkey, you know, Washington, D.C. There have been a lot of places where people have looked at this. And yet, the Food and Drug Administration takes the words of the ADA and only looks at the research that they say, this is what you should consider, don't consider anything else. It's a really a sad commentary on the ineffectiveness of our government health agencies not to bend to the will, you know, of the pharmaceutical companies or the dental companies or the people who have the money to spread around.
And, of course, unfortunately, we're doing tremendous harm to our young, to our elderly, to everybody who has mercury fillings in their mouth. And certainly in a country like Sweden, the Swedish government, which provides free medical and dental care, refuses to pay to have mercury fillings put in. They'll pay to have them taken out but not put in because they know how toxic it is. So how come the Swedes are so much smarter than we are over here, Doctor?
Well, I think they don't have the lobbying effort that we do, nor the fear of the lawsuits. That I would also expand on what you said. I gave a talk in Luxembourg in November, on November 7th, and this was a meeting of the European Union, primarily led by the people in Luxembourg, to gather data on amalgam fillings. And after that meeting, not only did Luxembourg, you know, put out a report on that, but in Norway, starting this year, you can't place an amalgam filling. Sweden and Denmark are in the same category. So the Scandinavian countries are way, way ahead of us with regard to this issue. They're the ones that are doing it. And at this time, I'd like to point out one other thing that I presented at that Luxembourg meeting. There's an enzyme that leads to tissue breakdown. It's called matrix metalloproteinase, which won't mean anything to your folks, but it's the enzyme that chews up the collagen that holds your cells together in your body. And that enzyme, we have found that enzyme, and specifically that enzyme, the only enzyme I know of that is activated irreversibly by mercury. In other words, the constant flood of mercury through our body is activating an enzyme that our body uses to break down the connection between cells, and this could lead to leaky gut syndrome, definitely leads to wrinkles, and you know, just what you would classify as aging.
Well, now, my understanding is that, of course, when the mercury fillings give off mercury, and that gaseous substance, it isn't necessarily all absorbed into the blood. Some of it, doesn't it actually get into the olfactory nerve and travel up into the brain that way?
Oh, yes. Even as it's being carried through the blood runs through the brain, and the mercury vapor can easily go through the blood-brain barrier. There's no doubt about that. And it's only after it goes through the blood-brain barrier that it gets converted to the toxic form, you know, the Hg2+ form, which is the one that causes the inhibition of specific enzymes.
Well, now, my understanding was that people who have Alzheimer's disease have a much higher level of mercury in their brains than the average person. Is that be correct?
You know, that's what other people have found. There's been one study that's touted by the American Dental Association as proving that wrong. But that study was led by a dentist who's here at my own university. I have no faith in that study at all because I know things about it that, you know, that hasn't come out in the literature. But the bottom line is what that study showed was nothing. They couldn't correlate. They couldn't even find elevated mercury in the brains of people that had the most amalgams compared to those that had none. And that tells you that the person doing the amalgam count was very, very likely not doing it very accurately or very well. And the interesting thing about that study also was that they found that the control individuals had double the mercury in their olfactory tissue than did the AD patients. And what that tells you is that somebody has picked AD patients with a lot less mercury exposure than the controls. That's how I would interpret that data.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, but that is simply one study. Aren't there many other studies that do show a definite correlation between the level of mercury in the brain and certainly the Alzheimer's disease?
Yes, and the one that I find the most compelling was one from Germany where they found that the blood of AD patients was significantly higher in mercury than that of HMASH controls.
All right, fine. And of course, the mercury gets into the blood, then it gets into the brain. And what does the mercury actually do in the brain? How does it affect it?
This is what my research showed, and that's that it binds to a protein. The major protein in the brain is the protein that forms the structure that holds the axons of the neurons in their proper shape. And mercury binds to that protein. It's a protein called tubulin, and renders it incapable of supporting the normal structure of the brain, which is what you see when you look at an AD brain. The neurite assemblies are all disrupted. And that we showed that mercury can do that. The famous video from Calgary where they add mercury to a living neuron and shows the tubulin stripping off of it, leaving the nerve fibrillary tangles, which is, by the way, the diagnostic hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. We've shown all of that, and yet our government totally refuses to consider even looking at it.
Well, now, what about the plaques? We hear all about this, talk about the plaques in the Alzheimer's brain. Where do those plaques come in from? What are those plaques?
Well, you know, that's interesting. They're formed by metals. There's no doubt about that, because just recently, I mean, maybe 2 weeks ago, the University of Rhode Island, researchers there released an article where they had taken monkeys and exposed them to lead when they were very young to see what effect it would have on their brain. And as these monkeys aged, they found that they had elevated amyloid plaques in their brain if they were exposed to lead at a young age. So the amyloid plaques are held together, and they are known to contain metals. Now, they talk about lead, they talk about copper and zinc, but no one has taken the time to measure the level of mercury in those plaques. But there's no doubt the amyloid plaques are caused by exposure of the brain to heavy metals such as lead, copper, and zinc, and most likely, since copper and zinc are needed in the brain, mercury.
And basically, then, of course, certainly the heavy metals or any sort of anything that's really very toxic to the brain will contribute to these amyloid plaques?
Yes, you know, we've shown, as well as have other people, if you take a non-toxic level of mercury and you mix it with a non-toxic level of lead, both of them not at the level where it would cause toxicity, that mixture will be 100% toxic. So it's what we call a synergistic toxicity, in which lead will increase the brain sensitivity to mercury that, you know, that these monkeys could have eaten in the food or breathed in the air that they were exposed to.
Well, do you think that fluoride would have any toxic effect on the brain, or at least it would have any sort of complementary effect as far as lead or as far as mercury is concerned?
Well, you know, it could have. I don't know of any papers where someone has measured that, but the bottom line is when you're hit with two toxic effects, one of them weakens the ability of the cell to respond to the second one. So that would fit in that, you know, fluoride would not be a very helpful thing to be exposed to.
Right, and of course we have to then wonder why they're adding it to our drinking water all across America. Well, certainly, you know, now what about animals? Are there animal studies, and what do the animal studies show as far as the effect of mercury on the brain?
Well, there are lots of studies. Mercury is classified as one of the most neurotoxic substances that anyone could be exposed to, and this is primarily based on, you know, just injecting it into rats or having rats breathe it. We did those kind of studies, and we certainly weren't the first, and what we found was severe brain lesions, lack of coordination, inability to run a maze, etc. That type of research has been around for a long, long time.
Well, then why are they putting it into mercury fillings that they put in the mouths of so many people across America? That doesn't make sense.
I think it's a matter of money. It's just money. And the prime culprit here is the American Dental Association. They were founded on the use of amalgam fillings, and they fight today. Even today, they're constantly putting out data saying that amalgams are totally safe and effective, even though the data's out there, and anyone can measure this. You know, your high school in your vicinity could make amalgam fillings or take amalgam fillings or people with amalgam fillings in their mouth and measure the mercury coming off of them. It's just a big lie, and it's an open-faced lie that's presented to the American people, and the Food and Drug Administration is compromised so badly that it cannot respond to this effectively.
And, of course, the Food and Drug Administration has tremendous power to determine what drugs will be released, and, of course, a large part of their budget comes from the drug industry. We'll be right back in just a moment. And we're just saying that a large part of the salary of the people who work for the FDA comes from the pharmaceutical industry. Most people don't know that, but somehow or other the pharmaceutical industry, supposedly because they were benefiting from the work of the FDA, and the FDA kept complaining they didn't have enough money to check and evaluate drugs adequately, so the pharmaceutical industry started giving millions and millions and millions of dollars to the FDA to supplement their budget so they could do a more efficient job. And the old adage of he who pays the piper calls the tune. And unfortunately, why, of course, there are many things that the FDA does that are not to the benefit of the people of this country, but to the benefit of the people who pay their salaries. And they don't necessarily work for the federal government, although they may get federal government pensions, but a large part of their salary and a large part of the expenses of FDA is covered by the pharmaceutical industry, and the average person has never heard that. Well, certainly the FDA is not doing anything at all to protect the health of the people who are getting mercury fillings. Why can't somebody bring a lawsuit against the people who manufacture the amalgam or against the Federal Drug Administration for malfeasance of duty?
Well, you know, they can, but they're not very likely to succeed because they have what's an FDA-approved product. But I can tell you that I'm the scientific advisor of the Consumer Dental Choice Group that has sued the Food and Drug Administration for not doing its job. And we've named as, plaintiffs in the suit, others in the suit, six of the officials at the FDA. And, you know, when you talk about the FDA, you know, we have to come back and not leave out the Center for Disease Control, which has a foundation that receives, you know, huge, huge sums of money from the pharmaceutical industry, in which they, the people that head the CDC, can give out as bonuses to the workers that work for them. So the CDC is in the same type of money-grubbing situation with industry as is the Food and Drug Administration. And then we have to say, well, they claim that they produce the best medicine in the world. Then what your audience needs to understand is that we're number 41 on the infant mortality list. That is, we have the highest vaccinated children in the world, and yet 40 countries have infants that live at a higher rate than the United States. And when I start naming countries that I think might fit into that category, I run out of countries that are what I would classify highly civilized and with a good network of medicine. So why are our children dying so fast, so much faster than children? In other words, if we have such good medicine and such good vaccines. And the problem is these vaccines aren't good for these children. They're just using children as a captive customer list. And this is pointed out in a recent study that just came out of Canada, where they looked at children that were, say, 18, 19 years old and that had been vaccinated either at 2 months of age or 4 months of age in Canada with the hepatitis vaccine. And what they found is if they were vaccinated at 2 months of age, they had roughly 16% rate of asthma. If they waited 2 months and vaccinated them in 4 months, they had a 5% chance of asthma. So you cut the asthma rate, from 15%, 16% to 5% by just waiting 2 months longer to vaccinate these children. And yet our government, no one here has done that type of study. They deny that, and they insist on vaccinating children on the day of birth with for a disease or an illness that they can only get by having sex with an infected person or using a dirty drug needle.
It really doesn't make sense, unfortunately. But
only from a money aspect.
Hold up right there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Haley was just talking about a study that recently came out of Canada where they actually took children who had the vaccination with hepatitis B at birth or, I guess, at 2 months, and then compared them with the children who had the vaccination at 4 months. Was that how it worked?
Yes.
And of course, they found out that in the group that was vaccinated at 2 months, why, when they followed them through to 15 or 16 or somewhere in there, why, they had an asthma rate of about 15%. If they didn't get vaccinated till they were 4 months old, they dropped asthma to 6%. So, I mean, here is certainly every evidence that we're producing asthma in our children with the vaccines, and yet where's the outcry in saying, we better change what we're doing?
And, if you can take that a step further, the FDA and the CDC, all of them know we have pushed it at them so many times that the Amish population, the non-vaccinated population, do not have asthma, and they also don't have autism. And yet, if you see any publication that is supported by CDC data, money, it will be directed not to finding out what's causing the epidemic, but directed at trying to show that the thimerosal, the mercury in the vaccines, doesn't. And so we have a real problem that we have, you know, a huge autism epidemic in this country, autism spectrum disorders, and yet no one is trying to find out what it is. Except one thing we know, they spent $25 million to find a genetic cause for autism, and they came up bankrupt. There is no genetic difference or abnormality that causes this disease to any significant amount. And so they keep spending money on that, and they keep trying to get the American public believing that autism is a genetic disease when in actuality it's caused by an environmental toxin of some sort. And the unusual thing about that environmental toxin, if you just use common sense and logic, is that it had to go up in the state of Alaska, Hawaii, California, Maine, Florida, and Nebraska at the same time. And the only thing I can think of that fills that bill is the mandated vaccine program by the CDC.
Well, I think, of course, anybody who's ever read the Southwood report that came out, I'm sure you're acquainted with it. I think it was out of Georgia back in 1999 or the year 2000, somewhere in there. And it was a secret meeting put on by the CDC where they heard about the statistics or the statistical evidence that had been gathered by the CDC that definitely showed it was the thimerosal in the mercury, because they had children who'd gotten vaccines with thimerosal and without thimerosal mercury. And, of course, some of the people there said, well, there's no question what it's about. How are we going to conceal it from the American people? Some fellow said, well, my grandchildren are certainly not going to get these shots with the mercury in it. But then they agreed to cover that information up. They made the minutes of the meeting top secret. Now, fortunately, we were able to get a copy of it. It's up on the Internet, or we can certainly make that available to people. Understand, the government knows they're poisoning our children, and they're doing it anyway, and they're covering it up. I think that's criminal malfeasance, don't you?
I absolutely do. I'm very well known for saying that these people have committed a criminal act in destroying our children, our children's health, and they're doing it knowingly, and if someone says, well, you know, you're a conspiracy theorist and that doesn't make sense, why would they do it? It's because they're the ones that made the problem. They were greedy. They were trying to help the pharmaceutical industries, probably for some reward that they imagined they would get if they increased the vaccine use by our children and give a captive customer list to the pharmaceutical industries. And in doing so, they made a big mistake. And now they're doing everything they can to cover it up. And, you know, at our university, we call that, you know, damage control. If somebody on campus does something that we know is not good and unthinkable, we don't advertise that they did it. They punish them. They get them out of the way. But they certainly don't want the people in the state to know that somebody at the university did something bad. And that's what the FDA and the CDC are doing now, especially with the vaccine thing. They're doing their best to cover this up because they don't want the American people to say, hey, we want better restrictions on our vaccines. We want them safety tested. We want somebody looking at the safety of them that's not involved in making money off of them or approving them for their use, just so we can have a check and balance. There is no check and balance with our vaccine program today. The person that runs the CDC approves them, and nobody checks on it.
Well, I think it really is criminal activity. And ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about the health of our children. We're talking about, well, an epidemic where 160 children has autism. But, of course, when you realize it's much more common in boys, it's somewhere between 1 in 65 to 1 in 90 boys in America has autism. And, of course, certainly 1 in 6 American children has some sort of a neurodevelopmental abnormality. And the fact that most people do not understand what's going on, the fact you're not hearing this discussed in the media, reflects the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. And later on, we'll tell you how you get the documentation for everything we've told you tonight. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. I guess this evening is Dr. Boyd Haley. And what about that lawsuit you were talking about being brought against the FDA? And is that going to include people in the CDC as well?
No, in this particular case, it doesn't, because this is about what it's all about is we're trying to force the FDA to do what it refuses to do, and that's to directly evaluate the safety of dental amalgams. They refuse to do it because the ADA doesn't want it done, and the ADA doesn't want this evaluation done because they know that amalgams cannot even remotely come close to passing any safety test because they release too much amount of mercury. And, you know, in a vapor form, that's one of the most toxic forms of mercury we know about. So we're suing them for not doing their job and trying to force them to go to federal court and do their job. That's basically what it's about. Now, there are several people in the FDA that we have contacted within the last 6 years, and they promised us that they were going to do an evaluation and a study of amalgam fillings, and then they kept us on that line for about 8 months, that they were going to do something that was going to be a new restriction in the use of amalgams. In other words, like most countries, you can't put mercury fillings in the mouth of a pregnant mother, a woman who's of childbearing age or a child. And yet in the United States, you can put it in anybody's mouth, which may account for why we have, shorter longevity than anybody else. The people in the United States, there are 28 countries that people live longer than the United States, and we brag about how good, excellent our medicine is. So this lawsuit is just trying to force the FDA to do its job.
And, of course, will there be any criminal penalties, or will there be any financial penalties? I would think
We're trying to. I don't know how the judges and everyone will look at it, because sometimes our legal system, for example, in the state of California, I was an expert witness for the state of California regarding the amount of thimerosal that would be safe, to be exposed to. And the opposition came up with a number, what they call a minimum acceptable daily level, that I pointed out to the judge, you double that amount, and if you give it to a human being, you will kill them. I mean, that was verified by research. People taking that much to try and commit suicide. And yet the judge agreed with the opposition that level of mercury was no effect level, that it didn't cause any problems. And double that, and you kill someone. And so, I mean, I sometimes wonder, how much money runs this country, and one's got to be very, very, concerned with that. But if you fight, and if a lot of people realize that people are doing things that are wrong, then you have a better chance of getting it corrected. And that's one good thing about the country. I mean, we can sue the FDA. We can bring it to the public's attention that the FDA has never, ever evaluated.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Professor Boyd Haley, Dr. Boyd Haley from the University of Kentucky. And before we go on, is there a website people could go to? Do you have any books or any other information you'd like to get out?
Yes, I mean, this is just the organization, nonprofit, the International Academy of Oral and Medical Toxicology. It's called the www.iaomt.org, and it's just a group of dentists and physicians that are trying to remove mercury exposure through medicine and dentistry into the population.
All right, fine. That's IAOMT, is that right?
That's
International
correct.
Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology.
Yes.
They have an excellent website. Incidentally, you can go there and you can find a dentist in your area who's trained in taking out mercury fillings. And believe me, you don't want to go to the average dentist and have them take out your mercury fillings, so you may get mercury toxicity. Certainly you want to go to somebody who's been trained and is affiliated with the IAOMT, the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. You want to go their list, find the doctors, the dentists who are trained, and go to one of them. Certainly, there is evidence that people who've got their fillings out have had certainly evidence of mercury toxicity, isn't there?
Yes, there is. There are two very prominent studies, and I was involved in both of them, but I mean, not as the researcher, and one of them was done by the Heavy Metals Biology Board in Sweden, which is part of the reason why they removed amalgams. And what they found, they took people that had neurological disorders, older people, and they did, blood testing and, health histories and everything that you could do to find out how these people were existing before they had their amalgams removed. After they removed the amalgams, they waited 3 years. They measured the mercury in their blood both before and after, saw a significant drop, and they especially saw a significant drop in the blood mercury of the 70% of the individuals who reported, you know, dramatic health improvements. That same type of study was repeated in New Zealand with the same effect. People that had their amalgams removed, if they had MS, they had less severe and fewer, you know, episodes, you know, that come along with it being, you know, sick with multiple sclerosis. And many of them got, you know, again, about 70% of the people showed marked improvement in their health by just having their amalgams removed.
In fact, I remember when I was in my medical training, we had an orthopedic surgeon practice in Oakland. And, you know, and of course, we used to see a lot of people with aches and pains and arthritic problems. And his treatment for that was to have them pull out all their teeth. And he had dramatic improvement in a lot of the people that he pulled all the teeth out on. And we always used to sort of make fun of him. But I'm not so certain that what he was doing was actually taking out all the mercury that was poisoning these people. Because certainly he was successful in what he did. And yet it was quite, well, why would pulling the teeth make people feel better? And, of course, at that time, the idea that the mercury fillings that were been put in all these people were poisoning them, that thought never crossed my mind. In fact, the first time I ever heard it, I thought that was the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. But sometimes we have to spend a long time re-educating ourselves, don't we, Doctor?
Yes, and there's almost no doubt about that, that if you, but there could be other reasons, you know, the major risk factor today for cardiovascular disease, low birth weight babies, atherosclerosis, cardiovascular disease is the severity of your periodontal disease. And 75% of Americans have some extent of periodontal disease, and it's well known that mercury enhances, you know, the severity of periodontal disease. In other words, mercury, if you have amalgams in your mouth, your periodontal disease is going to be worse, and there's absolutely no doubt that the toxins that are produced and periodontal disease are made more toxic by the presence of mercury.
Okay, fine. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for Dr. Boyd Haley. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question on this, we're really talking about the relationship between the mercury and Alzheimer's disease. Now, what about the thimerosal that's in the vaccines as relationship to Alzheimer's disease? Certainly the government is encouraging people to, older people, to take the vaccine for influenza, and yet there's really no evidence that it really helps, and they keep always telling us, oh, 36,000 people die every year of influenza, and of course that isn't true. Maybe 1,000 might die, but these are old, debilitated people. Most of the people, at least in my estimation, who die from influenza die of pneumonia or something else, and it has nothing to do with the influenza, but they're really trying to scare people, frighten people into getting that influenza shot, which is good for the people who manufacture the vaccine. But, of course, have you looked at all into the relationship between the thimerosal, the influenza shots, and the onset of Alzheimer's disease?
Well, you know, I haven't myself, but Dr. Freudenberg, who's a very well-known researcher, has done a study on individuals in nursing home, an epidemiological study, and what he found was that if you looked at the people who took a vaccine, a flu vaccine every year, were religious about getting their flu vaccine, and compared them to the people who absolutely refused to take a flu vaccine, that those that took the vaccine every year were 11 times more likely to be demented with Alzheimer's disease type dementia than those who refuse the vaccine.
And of course, we've actually have an interview with Dr. Freudenberg where he tells that he's a world famous immunologist, and of course this is something he's really been very, very concerned about. And 11 times more likely after 10 years to have Alzheimer's disease than the people who defied the medical establishment and refused to take the influenza vaccine. And I wonder why they're not telling about this on the evening news. Well, let's go ahead. We've got Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Did you have a question for our guest, Mike? No, let's see. Mike, do you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, just one question. About the hepatitis vaccine, I'm wondering why, if there's some reason why they choose that particular vaccine as a vehicle for this. The reason I ask is because it seems that Merck Laboratories chose the same thing to distribute the original HIV infection.
Well, of course, some people might question that, but be that as it may, the question is, why did they specifically choose the hepatitis B vaccine that they were monitoring? Do you have any idea? Of course, Mike is referring to the study that was done up in Canada that showed a definite relationship between the how early you got the hepatitis B vaccine and whether or not you developed asthma down the road.
Well, the reason they chose that to study because it's the first vaccine given to an infant.
In fact, it's supposed to be here in the United States. They insist on giving it in the nursery. It's a totally unnecessary vaccine.
On the day of birth. I mean, right. We do it 2 months earlier than the earliest Canadian study.
And then we wonder why so many of our children have asthma. And, of course, they used to have a full dose of the thimerosal in it. Fortunately, they've taken that out, but be that as it may, so it's the hepatitis vaccine and the adjuvants and the other things in it that I think contribute very, very strongly to the instances of asthma. Anything else, Mike?
No, good enough. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye. Of course, at the time they were actually studying that, or were they also studying, they probably had the thimerosal in the vaccine, didn't
they? Yes, they did. This was done at a time when the thimerosal was still in the vaccine.
Right.
And I would point out one thing. You know, there is no law against, even though the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics tell you that mercury is removed from vaccines. You know, that's not true. I mean, what is true is that they have recommended to the public to the pharmaceutical companies that they remove thimerosal from vaccines. They don't have to. So the CDC says we think it's a good idea, yet at the same time they tell all the physicians and the HMOs that thimerosal-containing vaccines are totally safe. Now, if you go to a state other than California, which has a law against it now since 2006, an HMO that's buying vaccines for all of its population, all of its babies that are insured under them, there is nothing to tell them that they cannot use a thimerosal-containing vaccine, which usually is the vaccine that's in a multiple-dose vial, which is markedly cheaper than the single-dose vials. And so there, even though you say it's available, it doesn't mean that these people are using it. And I would caution people that HMOs will do what's cheapest, because so many times mothers will call me and say, how do I know my child's not getting thimerosal? And I will tell them, look at the insert. And it's so many times, even this year, mothers will call me back and said they had thimerosal as a preservative in these vaccines, and this is what the doctor was going to give my child, even though I asked them not to do that, and even though they told me there was no thimerosal in her vaccine, there was.
And, of course, the doctors, I hate to say this, but the doctors really don't know much of what we're talking about tonight because, of course, the American Medical Association is just as complicit in this criminal activity as the American Dental Association is.
The only way we win, Dan, is we have to make a law saying there is no thimerosal allowed in vaccines in this country. Because as long as it's allowed, HMOs that want to make a profit, doctors that really don't care about their patients are going to buy the cheapest vaccine that they possibly can, and that's going to be the ones made with thimerosal.
And, of course, I think it's so vitally important that if you have your children yourself that are of an age to be vaccinated, or you have grandchildren, or you know other people, get the word out. They're poisoning our children. Well, let's go to Ken, who's calling from New York City. Hi, Ken. How are you doing?
Good evening, Doc. And your guest, my question is about the mercury in the fillings. And I guess it's really for both of you, the situation I went through. But about 2 years ago, and had a problem with a filling. And I've discussed the mercury situation with the dentist before, and he seems to be of the opinion that the amount of mercury is so small in amalgam fillings that it's irrelevant.
And well, I can answer that very quickly.
Yeah.
He's a mathematically challenged person. Because if you have a half a gram filling, which is not uncommon in a jaw tooth, as a matter of fact, a gram is not uncommon for the weight, but a gram, if we go by just one, would be a million micrograms, that would be 500,000 micrograms of mercury, because it's 50% mercury. And if you divide that and say it gives off an average of 5 micrograms a day, which would be a very toxic amount, you have a 100,000 days. And if you divide that by 364 days, you can see how many years that would last.
And the thing is, Ken, that your dentist may be a very sincere individual, but he's never heard the things we're talking about tonight. This is why you've got to get the information. You go up there. Do you have access to a computer?
Yes.
Certainly. Go up there on the website, www.iaomt, International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology, and get their material. And I think they even have a picture of the smoking tooth up there, a tooth that has been extracted long ago, and they're simply holding it with a pair of forceps and with a mercury sniffer, a screener. You can actually see the mercury coming off.
Right, the vapors.
Right, and so your dentist really doesn't know what he's talking about.
Well, he removed the mercury. He said the filling had a crack in it, so he replaced it with a plastic filling. He'll do that for his patients.
Good, I'm glad he did.
And, well, here's what happened, because I mentioned to him what I heard you say on a broadcast over the past year or so, that don't go to a conventional dentist when you have your mercury fillings removed, because you can cause more trouble than if you leave them alone. So I mentioned that to him, and he said, well, I have everything here to take care of any kind of residual problems that could result from extracting the mercury. So I trusted him, I guess, and he took it out, and he replaced it with a plastic filling or whatever. And about a week later, I got the worst sore throat and throat infection I ever got in my life. And I went to the regular doctor, he examined me, he said, you have a very bad infection in your throat. So he gave me 7-day supply of antibiotics, and I got better. But could that have been caused by him removing the mercury?
Well, the one thing that is well known is that there's a disease called phenocytosis. That's where your macrophages are eating your red cells and your other blood cells. And it's a very severe disease, and so people want to develop drugs that will inhibit that activity, you know, when it's going wild, like it can in phenocytosis. And the compound or the element that inhibits that at the very lowest concentration, the most potent inhibitor of your body's, and that is the first step in your immune system, by the way. That's when your macrophages are eating bad bacteria. That process is inhibited at 1 nanomolar levels of mercury. And you got a lot more than 1 nanomolar level
right.
of mercury in your body from having that amalgam removed without somebody doing it properly. Now, I don't know how he did it. He may have done a good job removing it without exposing you, but unless he put in a rubber dam, had someone sucking...
No, he just drilled out the old mercury filling.
He did you dirt, is all I can say.
All I can say, Ken, is certainly be very, very careful, because I've talked to people who've had mercury toxicity, and you know, after getting the dental amalgams out and totally wiped out. You're very fortunate.
Okay,
God
bless
you.
Gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Let's go to Jeff calling from Spokane. Jeff, do you have a question for our guest?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I do have I know that time is short here. When they put in the mercury-free, I'm talking about my daughter now, she had a very small filling, and it was pink. They put in this pink material in there that turned white when it was completely dry. Is that amalgam or mercury-free type of product that you know of?
Yes, it is. That's a composite.
That's what we're looking for. And then on my teeth, obviously I'm 46, so I've had a few fillings over the years, and I look in my mouth and they're silver. They look silver. Is this something that I need to be having removed immediately?
Well, you know, I mean, don't panic. I mean, trust me, it's not worth panicking about. The only time I would really worry, there are two situations that identify that you want to take this more serious than the average person, and that's if you have neurological diseases in your family, like if you have a father or mother with AD or ALS or MS or Parkinson's, then you're someone that probably cannot excrete mercury very well. The second thing is if you're an APOE4/4, that's a gene type. There's three categories, 2, 3, and 4. And it appears as if the 4/4 are the ones that are more susceptible or unable to protect themselves from mercury toxicity in the central nervous system. And I mean, it depends on the makeup. I would find a good mercury-free dentist that, you know, would take them out carefully and I would do one quarter of my mouth at a time. I wouldn't panic about it, but I would get them taken out safely. They're not good for anybody.
One quarter at a time. Okay, one quarter of the mouth at a time. And then the last thing, I know our time is really short, is there a product that we can take, that I could take to sort of detox, just in case there is some stuff in my system?
We're working on that.
All right. You're going to have to just keep listening, Jeff. We'll have to do some programs on that later, but we're out of time right now.
Thank you, sir.
God bless. Thanks so much. And, of course, that was Jeff calling from Spokane, Washington. Well, anyway, we've had a good smattering of calls from across the country. Our guest has been Dr. Boyd Haley. And, of course, he suggests that if you want more information, you go to the website www.IAOMT, and that stands for the International Association of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. I've been there many times. Go there. You can see the smoking tooth right there. Well, Dr. Haley, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program, and certainly the scourge of Alzheimer's disease is devastating so many of our elderly people, and what a tragic situation it is. Certainly, Alzheimer's disease really seems to be increasing in our society, doesn't it?
Well, you know, you would expect it, because, you know, the golden age of placing amalgam fillings was after World War II. And these are the children, you know, the baby boomers, who are now reaching the age where, you know, they lose the ability to protect their body from the mercury exposure that they're getting on a constant basis. You know, there's a compound in our body called glutathione that binds to mercury and removes it, you know, and is used to remove it, you know, through the fecal route. And as we age, the amount of that compound we make drops, and as that drops, we become more sensitive to mercury. And that fits into exactly what we see with autistic children. If you look at autistic children, they have half the level of this glutathione that normal children have. And that's what makes them susceptible to low levels of mercury exposure. That's the reason all kids don't get autism. It's just those that are that have very, very low glutathione levels to do. And so on the other end of the spectrum, you know, the older people, as they age, they go through life with 10, 15 amalgam fillings, and they do fine until they hit 60, 65, 70. Then all of a sudden the glutathione levels start dropping because they're aging, and they can no longer detox the mercury that they're being exposed to on a daily basis.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Since we've started interviewing you and other people on mercury, I've had all of my mercury fillings out, and I really think it's an excellent idea for older people. Why take a chance? Because, of course, the alternative is so horrible to contemplate. And when I see some of my very, very good friends with Alzheimer's disease and really incapable of thinking and functioning of course, it's one of the greatest tragedies of modern day times. Well, certainly, I appreciate so much you taking the time to be with us. I know it's fairly late back there in Kentucky, but I think...
You've got me 2 hours past my bedtime.
I know, but this is such an important subject.
Yes, it is.
I would really like to get you onto our other programs, perhaps an earlier time, but I did want to do it here so we'd have a good copy of the program. I think it's something you're just going to keep hammering about, and please let me know how that lawsuit turns out. I just hope that you can force the FDA to do the right thing and to stop allowing our people, our children, and our adults to be poisoned.
Okay.
Well,
good talking to you, Stan.
Good night.
I always enjoy this.
God bless. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, our guest this evening has been Dr. Boyd Haley, and he's on the front lines of this battle. And believe me, when you get into this battle, and you get on the front lines of the battle, you come under tremendous pressure because somebody doesn't want the truth to come out. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope that you enjoyed our conversation this evening with Dr. Boyd Haley. And I don't think there's any question that certainly mercury is an important aspect of Alzheimer's disease. And the thing is that the people in government know that. I mean, there's no question that they know it, and they're covering it up. And why would you do something like that? Well, you have to understand that there are too many elderly people, and there really is a population control agenda. And if you haven't seen my population control agenda monograph, it's at my website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. If you'd like really to get into the background of thimerosal and as far as its toxicity, as far as vaccines are concerned, autism, and, of course, why, although we've supposedly removed most of the mercury from our childhood vaccines here in the United States, we've left it in. to the childhood vaccines that were given throughout the world. You need to get an excellent DVD. It was a talk given by Dr. David Ayoub, and it's called Mercury Autism and the Global Population Agenda. And when you get that, you'll get a CD-ROM with literally thousands of pages of documentation on the toxicity of mercury, which the government knows about and they don't want you to know about. So let me suggest again the DVD, Mercury Autism and the Global Population Agenda. And then, of course, certainly I suggest very strongly my talk on the hidden agenda. Now, that's on fluoride, another toxin that they're exposing us to in the water. But there you'll actually get the pages from the book written by Bertrand Russell, The Impact of Science on Society, where he talks about how we're going to, of course, use diet and injections and injunctions to control the minds of our children. Well, how would you control the minds of children with diet and injections? Why, very simply. You'd feed them poisons and you'd inject them with poisons. You need to read that in his own writings. We have permission to reproduce those pages. And that is the talk, the syllabus, the hidden agenda. We have 2 4 tape or 4 CD sets on Mercury and Mercury Update. We actually have 2 videos on Mercury. Of course, we have the book Evidence of Harm. This really more or less talking about autism. We have a 4 tape set on autism. And people find it so difficult to believe that anybody would want to poison our children, would want to poison our people. But the truth of the matter is they do. They're poisonous with mercury. They're poisonous with fluoride. And if you want the excellent website there, it's fluoridealert.org. Fluoridealert.org. And don't put in com or net, because those are the websites taken by the ADA, hoping that you'll go there by mistake. You'll forget the proper name, and of course you'll get the American Dental Association lies that they're putting out about how safe water fluoridation is. And they know, of course, that most of the fluoridation is done with hydroflow silicic acid that contains lead and cadmium and polonium-20, as well as fluoride. Why would you give people cadmium and lead and polonium-20? That's what they poisoned Litvinenko over in London with, the fellow who wrote the book on blowing up Russia. You have to understand there are people who have a different worldview, and they hate humanity. They really do. Now, most people don't want to admit that, but there really are people who want to kill off the majority of the world population. You need to, of course, read my Population Control Agenda monograph. It's available on our website, or if you order something and specifically request this, we'll be glad to send it to you free of charge. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you will certainly go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. We also have a DVD called Nundare College Genocide. That's Nundare College Genocide. Another one called Planned Population Reduction, which is a much more detailed version of planned Nundare College Genocide. We have a video called Population Control. And as absurd as it may seem to rational people, we're dealing with people who really have a different worldview, who see nothing wrong with poisoning the American people. They're the same ones, of course, who helped the Nazis escape to South America and come to the United States after World War II in Operation Paperclip. We also have a 4-tape set on Operation Paperclip. Pray for America. Pray for revival. But please pray for Radio Liberty, because there really are evil and wicked forces out there. Time we recognize them. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion and illusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Barry Shamish, and we're going to be talking about Israel, because Barry is an Israeli citizen. He's fought in Israel's wars, and he's a writer, and Sydney has had a fascinating life, met all sorts of fascinating people, has written extensively on the murder of Rabin, the premier of South Israel, and pointing out that this was a government hit, involved the Shin Bet, which is the counterpart of the FBI, and that they simply murdered the prime minister of Israel, and is because of attacks on and threats to Barry's life, he's come to live in the United States, and Israel's loss is our gain because we can share in his wisdom, and he knows so many of the people that are involved in the unfolding saga. And of course he points out that the leaders of Israel are intent upon destroying Israel, and they have different allegiances. Certainly Olmert, controlled by the Council on Foreign Relations. John McCain comes from the Council on Foreign Relations of the United States. Hillary Clinton's husband, Bill Clinton, comes from the Council on Foreign Relations. The Council on Foreign Relations always controls the political system here in the United States, both political parties, and it doesn't really matter whether we get the Democrats or Republicans, because the same policy always continues, and that policy is influencing what's going on in Israel and is not intent upon the preservation of the sovereignty and integrity of Israel, but upon its destruction. So with that as a background, Barry Shamish, thank you very much for being with us again tonight.
Thank you for having me. You forgot Mitt Romney is in the CFR.
No, I don't believe he is. He's surrounded by CFR people, but I don't believe he's a member. Have you actually seen his name on the list?
You know what? I got the list. While we're talking, I'll go through the list, and I'll verify this. For you,
because it's so here we have to be accurate, because we've got thousands of people out there who call in and tell us we're wrong. So you check that out. You go right ahead now, and certainly but you go right ahead and tell us what you're going to do.
What you've got to do is just congratulate us for not being wrong about the Sinai and the effect it's going to have on Israel. And, well, the terrorism hit, of course.
Now, of course, what Barry is talking about is, of course, when the people actually took down the wall between Gaza and the Sinai, which is Egyptian territory, and then, of course, they streamed out, 500,000 people streamed out into the Egyptian territory, and many of them returned, but some of them did not, and those, of course, are terrorist bands hiding in the Sinai, planning then to break through the border, which is very, very poorly guarded between Egypt and Israel. And Barry's been saying there'd be terrorist attacks on the adjacent cities adjacent to the border. And this last week we had a major terrorist attack, probably with those people from Gaza, the terrorists who came in across the scantily guarded border. And, of course, there are probably lots more just waiting to come in to kill Israeli citizens. So pick the story up there.
Well, that's certainly the case. Mitt Romney is not the CFR.
Okay.
Okay, I have my CFR list handy, and you were right.
All right. Well, I'm right once in a while.
By the way, it's going to be McCain and Clinton, and this election has nothing to do with the American people actually having a choice in who runs for president. They fight each other over nothing issues, and they have debates, but in the end, the CFR wins, and McCain versus...
Hold that thought, we'll be right back.
Totally right.
Okay, go right ahead, Barry.
McCain versus Clinton is what they've been wanting, it's what they've been pushing for, and if you think that you can grow up in a log cabin and split rails and then just rise to the presidency, those days are gone. Just so you should know this, they're just as gone in Israel. but they're really gone in this country too. I assume your listeners know this already.
Well, I think they probably do. If they are regular listeners, they probably have a pretty good idea of what's going on.
I would imagine so. But this was a terrible terror attack in Dimona, but it could have been a lot worse. A policeman killed the second bomber, who was all ready to kill all the medics and just anyone who came to help after the first bomber. So you had two Israelis dead. It could have been dozens. But there's a profound confusion in Israel about who these bombers belong to. Everybody is taking responsibility for them, and nobody knows really who they belong to, because apparently there are dozens of hit squads sitting in the Sinai ready to do the exact same thing. To this day, Israel will not say if they came from the Sinai or they came from Hebron, and they're actually fighting over who was behind this this atrocity. What's happening right now in Israel is an open front along a 130-mile border without a fence. And that's what's happening, and Israel doesn't know what to do with it. And the southern cities of Israel are all preparing, and they've avoided this for years, terrorism. For years they've avoided terrorism. And now, everywhere from Eilat to Beersheba to Arad, Dimona has already been hit. The 500,000 people who live in the Negev are now every bit as vulnerable as if they had lived in Judea and Samaria. All of Israel is now open to vicious terrorism. There's not a safe place in the country anymore.
I really think, of course, that this has been set up by the leaders of Israel because they want the people to have this feeling of hopelessness, and that, of course, they'll be willing to make any concessions that the leaders want to. Anything for peace, and that's the tragedy. Anything for peace, well, you don't sacrifice your principles for peace. There comes this time when you have to fight.
Well, again, let's repeat, and I'm going to go into it, by the way, in detail. The fact of the matter is...
Hold that thought, Barry. We're just going to bring our stations back on board right this very minute here. All right, fine. Well, Barry's talking about the terrorist attacks there here in one of the cities and adjacent to the border between Israel and Egypt. And this has always been peaceful. It's been guarded, and the terrorists have not come in there, but now they came in. And it's assumed that there are many, many terrorist bands hiding in the Sinai, waiting to move into Israel to wreak havoc among the people there. So, unfortunately, the two people died, but it could have been far worse had the policeman not shot the second terrorist there. Why, of course, he could have killed dozens more. So, pick up the story there.
You know, there was a time before suicide bombers. There was a joke, I think it came after the Six-Day War, or after the Yom Kippur War, that the Arabs had developed an atomic grenade that was so powerful that one grenade could make a crater 300 yards in diameter. And the punchline was, the average Arab can throw a grenade about 100 yards.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, nowadays, that's not a joke anymore. The Arab will kill himself with his atomic grenade. And this is what happened to Dimona. They blew themselves... Well, one was shot dead before he blew himself up. But it's a whole different mentality now. You've got a whole people actually brainwashed that life is better if you're dead. And this is so unpredictable for the Israeli security forces, who assume that the opponent wants to live. And that's not the case anymore. The opponent wants to die, and that's just not in the rule books. Okay, when they wrote the rules for IDF combat, they assumed the opponent would leave a bomb and run. They didn't think that he would be the bomb, and this is just not something they know how to fight against.
Well, it's pretty hard to fight against people who want to commit suicide. We saw that at the end of the Second World War with the kamikaze Japanese pilots who were going to fly their planes, and rather than try to come in and bomb or strafe, they were just going to crash them into our ships, and they wreaked a terrible, terrible havoc on the United States Navy. This fanaticism in the Japanese is so similar to the Japanese, pardon me, the fanaticism we're seeing in these Islamic suicide bombers.
Well, don't give them ideas. You know, the next Piper Cub in Gaza can be filled with a lot of explosives and crash into a city. And by the way, that's not as crazy as it sounds. That sounds real to me. But let's go, this is something I had prepared. We had spoken about a subject last week, and I said it'll take too long, so I actually wrote the notes. And the subject is, why don't the Israeli parties bring down the government already? It's an incompetent government. There was a report, the Winograd report, was a cover-up in every respect, but nobody with any self-dignity would stay in that government. That government killed 150 Jews, not to mention the eight Israeli soldiers murdered before the kidnapping of three, and everyone should leave. I mean, it's that simple. You don't stand in a shamed government. Now, let's do this piece by piece. Avigdor Lieberman left last week.
And he headed one of the parties there, and he left the Knesset, is what you're saying, right?
Yes, he had 11 seats. You saw Betaino was the party. We explained what happened to him. As soon as he left the government, they started opening every police file in the book. They interrogated his daughter. One interrogation went for six straight hours. She left bleary-eyed and crazy, but that's one reason why you don't leave the government. And I'm about to describe the Shas party. But previous to that, Ehud Barak is the defense minister of Israel.
All right, and good. Perez is the president and Olmert is the prime minister. Is that right?
What a team, my lord. Repeating those names makes it even worse than saying them.
with a team like that in charge, you don't need enemies.
My lord, what a group of clowns.
But Olmert really has almost no support from the Israeli people. What's his support?
He sure doesn't. But he's got the support of the Labor Party. Now, Ehud Barak said that depending on the Vinograd report, there's no W in Hebrew, he would leave the government. And then after it came out, he professed to be shocked by it and said he was considering leaving the government. And 2 days ago, he said he was going to stay in the government. This is the defense minister. Now, we've done this before, and I'm not going to do it again. Barak is not just a cowardly weasel. He's a murderer. But he's staying in the government. The big question is, the next big party is Shas. Now, for those who don't know, I'm going to try and make this discussion as easy as possible. Just kind of drift into the rhythm of the evil and the criminality without concentrating too much on the names.
Well, just for our listeners out there, Israel has a number of political parties, not simply two major parties like we have. They have a number of parties. They have the Labor Party, and they have the, certainly Barry knows the names of all of them, but, you know, when a majority of the people leave the Knesset, that's a vote of no confidence, and then, of course, the Prime Minister has to call a new election. But other than Lieberman leaving, why, it doesn't look like anybody else is going to leave, so pick up the story there.
Nope. Now, Shas left, Olmert would no longer have a Jewish majority. Like that means anything anymore, but amongst the Israeli people, that still means a lot, that the Arabs decide what your policy is. That's what Rabin did, by the way. He let the Arabs give Israel the Oslo Accord, and Rabin said if he didn't have a Jewish majority, he wouldn't go ahead. Everything has changed. We're letting the Arabs decide Israel's future, but still, if Shas left, Olmert would no longer have a Jewish majority.
And, of course, the Arabs actually have some sort of a bloc in the Knesset, don't they?
Well, I wouldn't say it as a bloc so much as support of Olmert. They throw the support at him, and you've got, I guess about 10 Arab boats will keep him in power. But it's immoral. I mean, it's immoral for the Jewish people to have their future decided by these 10 Arab boats. That goes without saying. You don't have to take a course in ethics and philosophy and whatever else to know that if you depend on your enemy to decide your future, the people are going to be a little distraught that the future of their nation is being decided by the people who despise them. So if Shas leaves the government, well, we have a new situation, at least ethically. Now, Shas will never leave the government, and I'm going to tell you a really, really remarkable story. And as I said, don't worry about the names.
All right, fine. Because this is the political party we're talking about, so go right ahead.
Well, they're an orthodox, what you call Haredi party. But they're also primarily Moroccan. Now, what happened way back in 1984 is that Peres lost another election, and he ended up in a tie with Shamir, and they split the government. It happened twice in a row because the Moroccans would not vote Labor. And why should you vote for a party that x-rayed your brains, kidnapped your children, everything that was done to the Moroccans and the Sephardim in general by the Labor Party in the 50s was not forgotten. And you cannot get a Moroccan to vote Labor. This is extremely rare. Now, just so you know, Labor used to have a Moroccan leader. His name was Amir Peres. He was the defense minister during the fiasco of what is known as the Second Lebanon War. I call it the Oslo War. And there are people who say that the army and the people in charge of Israel, the real secret government, the establishment, actually lost the war to get Amir out of the Labor Party leadership. I've heard this. And by the way, that would not surprise me. I don't know this for sure. The next stuff I know for sure. But I'll bet you anything there's something to that story. But let's go back to 84. Peres lost an election, but there's a new party in parliament. It only had three or four seats. It was the Shas party. Now, Peres works it out that he would have been prime minister if the Moroccans voted for him. But he says to his people, we don't need the Moroccans anymore. All we need is the Moroccan party, Shas. And he comes up with a strategy that he is going to corrupt the Shas party. Now, he concentrates, it's a religious party, remember, so the rabbi, Rabbi Avadia Yosef, who until that time, as far as anyone knows, was honest. Today, he's just a pathetic crook. In the lowest of felonious crimes, you have this rabbi. But back then, as far as anyone knew, he was honest. Now, he had a secretary, a 23-year-old named Aryeh Deri, who is a legend in Israel. You may not know him, but he is a legend. And what Peres did is he sent three of his cronies, Moshe Shachal, Yossi Beilin, and Chaim Ramon, to thoroughly corrupt Deri. Now, let's just stick with Chaim Ramon because he is the deputy prime minister of Israel. The other two, another time. Ramon's deal was that he gave 23-year-old Aryeh Deri, totally uneducated, a secretary to the rabbi, $50,000 to be the negotiator in the sale of a bank he represented. It was called Carmel Bank. So from Chaim Ramon, today's deputy prime minister, I'm going to repeat these things.
Hold those thoughts. We'll be back in just a moment. All right, our guest is Barry Shamish. He's talking about how first they set out then to corrupt the secretary of the rabbi who led the was affiliated with the Moroccan political party. And the Moroccan Jews are the Sephardic Jews, and certainly they've been very, very badly treated by by the rest of Jewry. We pick the story up there.
Well, especially Paris. We won't do that today. I mean, Paris is such a murderer, and Sephardim were his targets. And we have discussed the kidnapping of the Ammonites and the X-raying of all Sephardic children. That was Paris. But let's not get lost. This is a tough story, and we'll do our best here. Chaim Ramon is deputy prime minister. That means if over it goes, you have to flip a coin to see who becomes prime minister, either foreign minister Livni or Chaim Ramon. And I'll give it to Ramon. He's got a little more dirt on everyone. But he, again, gave Derry $50,000, supposedly, to be a brilliant negotiator in the sale of the Carmel Bank. That was his role in the corruption. The whole story, again, will lead to another day, but we have to stick with the facts of today. Now, I started following the story with my partner. At the time, we ran a newsletter called Inside Israel. My partner was Joel Baderman. Now, we read somewhere, obscure, but somewhere, that two deputy mayors of Jerusalem, Shmuel Meir and Arnon Yekutieli, both of whom are dead today. Meir was murdered, and we'll talk about that another time. He knew a little too much for his own good, and he was murdered. What they said is that Derry was forcing... Oh, I want to add something. At age 25, thanks to Paris and his corruption, Derry was made Interior Minister of Israel, the youngest minister by about 15 years. 40 was like a young minister before Derry. 25-year-old Derry becomes the Interior Minister of Israel. Now, in that position, he controlled money, lots and lots of money. Now, what Yekutieli and Meir told us. Now, me and Joel made appointments to interview them separately, and they were very, very decent. Now, Yekutieli was a very far leftist, but he was honest. What he told me was the same as what Shmuel Meir told us, and he was a rightist. The story was that Derry was using school subsidies to line his back pocket. And the method was the school subsidies come from the Interior Ministry. And he was telling, well, certainly in Jerusalem, these people were the deputy mayors of Jerusalem. I assume it was happening throughout the country, that schools could not receive their legal subsidy. He would prevent them receiving the money unless they transferred part of the subsidy back to the Shas party. That was his crime.
Okay.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm there, and certainly that doesn't sound like a very honest thing to do. We'll be back in just a moment with Barry Shamish. Well, Barry was just telling us that certainly this very young person who'd been the secretary to the aging rabbi actually was corrupted. First of all, he was given $50,000 to negotiate a sale of a bank or something of the sort, and then he suddenly becomes a minister, and of course he is controlling a great deal of money. The school subsidies, and he tells the schools they're not going to get the subsidies unless they give part of the money to the Shatz party, this new political party that is coming up. And of course, Perez wants to control this political party. He wants it to grow strong. And of course, originally it was a Moroccan party. And the Moroccans hated everything that Perez stood for. But of course, it always happens why eventually people are corrupted. So anyway, of course, then they start giving money to the Shatz party, government money, to one of the political parties that controls the government. Now, that certainly doesn't sound very proper to me, Barry.
Oh, boy. This is just scratching the surface, but there's much, much more. Now, we're going to go back to the year 1988. There's another election. Once again, we've got a tie. Now, what they did is the same thing they did last time. that Peres would be the prime minister for the first 2 years, and Shamir would be the prime minister for the next 2 years. That's how you handle a tie in Israel. Well, 1988 to 90, Peres is prime minister. Then Shamir takes over, and Peres would not tolerate Shamir being the prime minister. He was going to fell his own government. Now, how it was done was really ugly and stupid. He got the help from the CFR, Peres. James Baker of the CFR goes to Cairo and negotiates what is called the Baker Plan with Hosni Mubarak. It is a five-point plan for peace in the Middle East. One of the points was that Jerusalem would be up for negotiations, which everyone knew Shamir would reject. And way back then, by the way, all of Israel would reject that. Nowadays, you've made a mess out of everything. But back then, Jerusalem was the capital. You did not divide the capital up. You didn't turn into Belfast or Beirut or Berlin. Nobody wanted that done. So everyone knew that Shamir would reject the Baker Plan. So Peres says, if we don't, Peres has a new campaign, say yes to Baker. And if you don't say yes to Baker, well, we're going to put in a vote of non-confidence. Now, now we go back to the two deputy mayors that Joel and I met in the City Hall of Jerusalem. They were both very nice to us and very open with us, and both told us the same story. And this was the shocking part, that socially they had met the deputy finance minister. The finance minister in 1990 was Shimon Peres. He took the job so that he could go through all of the thefts that Dery and his party had undertaken after he corrupted them. I mean, here's the ultimate irony. He knew Dery was stealing because he corrupted him. Now, one of the people who corrupted him, and we'll do this another day perhaps, was Yossi Beilin, who, by the way, is the head of the Meretz Party in Israel, and who gets billions of dollars funneled at him from the Europeans to bring down Israel, and he is a thoroughly, thoroughly despicable
figure. Hold that thought, we'll be right back here.
Right.
No, go right ahead. Go right ahead.
Yeah, these little breaks are very confusing, but Yossi Beilin again.
All right, go ahead.
Both Yekutieli and Meir tell us that they met Beilin socially. And Beilin, I have the exact quote here, what they told both politicians, municipal politicians, here it is. We are going to bring down Shas. We have them in our back pockets. And both of them said to him, well, fine, you can keep Shas in your back pocket for a day or two, but that's as far as it goes. And he says, nope, I know it's illegal, but we've got them for good. Beilin knew exactly what Peres was going to do to have a vote of no confidence around the say yes to Baker issue. He had Shas blackmailed. Now, all of Israel is watching. I'm watching. Everyone's watching this vote of no confidence, which Shamir is going to win. Except for, whoops, is that the music again?
That's the music again, I'm afraid. So go right ahead. I'll tell you when to stop.
Well, what the public didn't know is that Peres had said to Dery, if you don't lead your party against Shamir, you're going to jail. And Deputy Finance Minister Beilin collected every stolen penny and presented it to Dery and said, here's the fact. You are going to say yes to Baker.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. That's James Baker III, of course.
It is indeed.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Barry Shamish, and he's just simply explaining how they corrupted this political party and have controlled it for many years. Go right ahead, then, with the story.
Well, the corruption will lead to murder. Just have patience. So, we watch TV, and lo and behold, Shas does not support Shamir, and the government falls. To everyone's shock, the government falls. This was in, if I'm not mistaken, it was in March of 1990. Now, the president then, again, we won't go into him right now, that was Chaim Herzog. He tells Peres to form a government. Now the real trouble starts. Derry is fighting for Peres now, or he gets thrown in jail for massive theft. But he can't do it. After, what is it, 40 days, Peres cannot put together a party to say yes to Baker. Nobody wants to say yes to Baker. And Herzog gives him another 44 days to put a party together. Israel was without a government for 88 days. I mean, without a government. You had a prime minister who was out, and you had another guy who couldn't put together a government. And at the end, Shas said no because of the pressure from its constituents not to give up Jerusalem. And lo and behold, Shamir was prime minister, Peres had failed, and the Derry scandal suddenly erupted into full blossom in June of 1990 because Derry didn't deliver Shas to Peres. Now, I don't know how much sense that makes to you. Every Israeli knows this story more or less. Not exactly the way I'm telling it. They know the conventional history. Now, we are going to lead to murder because now Derry is under indictment for massive fraud. All the money that he stole out of the Israeli government treasury, they were talking $50 million in 1990 money. It was a massive amount. Some went to his back pocket. Most went to his party. But there was one, he was only actually charged and was forced to stand trial on a couple of these charges. The two of them that stand out, one, where did he get $170,000 to buy a house in the Jerusalem religious neighborhood?
Hold that thought, we'll be back in just a moment here. All right, fine. Well, this is our guest, is Barry Shemesh. And Barry, we will not have any more interruptions until just about the end of the program. But our guest is Barry Shemesh. He's been telling us a fascinating story about this young man who had started out as a secretary assistant to the rabbi who had the Sephardic party there, the Moroccan party. And then he was, of course, corrupted by Peres and actually encouraged to steal a lot of money. And eventually, of course, when he refuses to go along with some of Peres's demands, such as turning Israel over so it can be divided with the Arabs, and when he refuses to go along with that, why, of course, he's indicted for stealing millions and millions of dollars, and of course, he eventually probably, well, we'll find out from Barry. But before we get to that, Barry, I want you to get out your website. I want you to tell people how they can get your books, how they can get your DVDs, and then we'll get back and find out what happened to this gentleman, foolish young man who got himself involved with Peres, got a lot of money from him, and eventually became corrupted, and now he's going to have to stand trial as punishment, because, of course, he would not betray his country. At least he...
Oh, no. He may have been finance minister, but he wasn't in the Knesset. He didn't refuse one little bit to help Peres. The rest of his party let him down.
Oh, I see. Okay, the party let him down. That it wasn't him. But anyway, go ahead and tell us how, you know, they can get in touch with you, and then we'll let you tell the story, because you know it a lot better than I do.
Oh, like the back of my hand. All right, the books. This comes from a book, the Derry scandal comes from my book, Save Israel. And amongst my other books, that is on lulu.com. www.lulu.com. Now, you write in the upper right-hand corner search box, you write my name, Shamish. C-H-A-M-I-S-H. It'll take you to all my books, including Save Israel, for this remarkable story. The website is officially the Barry Shamish website, but go to, nowadays you just go to barrychalmers.com and it'll forward you. And I have these DVDs. They're just as expansive as I am, with a lot more detail. And I have a new MP3 DVD. You just put it in your computer or your DVD set, and you have 124 radio shows from last year, 2007. And if you order it, I'll out a book or another DVD as a present. So it's a real bargain for, let's say, $20. And you can phone me on this one. 904-501-7605. That's 904-501-7605. And now we're back to Derry. I've almost forgotten. Oh, yes. He was indicted on just a very few crimes. The police have interrogated him into the dust. One was $170,000 that he bought in cash, okay, in cash. He bought a new apartment in Harnoff, a religious neighborhood in Jerusalem, with cash. And nobody knows where the cash came from. It sure didn't come from his salary. Also, friends of his, including Moshe Reich. Reich was a co-conspirator. He was indicted for bribing Derry with $100,000 in cash. Now, here's where the story starts getting murder. We're talking murder next. Now, the Shas party doesn't just go down with Derry, but Derry is the scandal of Israel. And by the way, I mean that when I say that. The Derry scandal went on for a decade. He finally sat in jail for a year and a half, and he tried to fight his way out of it all the way to the year 2000. From 1990 to 2000 was nothing but keeping Derry out of jail. And this was undoubtedly the scandal of that decade. In case you didn't know that, look up R.E.A. Derry on Google, D-E-R-I, and write Derry scandal, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Now, it gets really nasty here. Now, he had a wife named Yaffa. He still has a wife named Yaffa, an orphan. And, no, I'm sorry, I don't think she was an orphan. I'm not even sure if her parents are alive. I guess they're not. Because a couple in Brooklyn, Holocaust survivors, Esau and Esther Verdiger, adopt her. I mean, adopt her in order to educate her. They didn't have children of their own. He was just a factory worker, worked in a clothing factory. They didn't have a lot of money, but they decided to educate a Jewish girl named Yaffa Cohen so they'd leave something behind, a little bit of a heritage. And they met her like twice. I mean, really, it wasn't an adoption like they raised her. It was an adoption to give her adopted daughter an education. Derry wanted them. Esar died in 1990. In 1992, Derry is fighting for his life. So he sends an attorney. Well, first of all, he sends his people to New York to get Esther Verdiger to sign an affidavit that she gave Derry the $170,000 in cash to buy his apartment. That's how he was going to get out of this theft. Unfortunately, for Derry, and I don't know why he did this, eventually he sends, via the police, it's a long story, the police were deeply corrupt on this, an attorney named Shmuel Weinberg to Esther Verdiger's apartment, and he records the conversation. And for reasons that are just entirely unknown to me, there were two tapes. Derry's lawyers submitted this tape to the Israeli court to prove Derry's innocence. And the tape was released to an obscure magazine called Yerushalayim. And I read the tape in full. It didn't get into the common press. It was just a very obscure piece. It was a shock to anyone who read it, because Shmuel Weinberg is pressing her, and I mean viciously pressing her, to sign the affidavit, and she's saying no. And at the end, again, you read my book, Save Israel, and you read this horrible, horrible press job for her to forge an affidavit. And she says, I know you're going to kill me. You think I don't know you're going to kill me? She says, I don't want to live anymore. Go ahead and kill me. I think it was less than 2 weeks later. She's crossing Queens Boulevard. She did live in Brooklyn. She lives in Queens, actually. She's crossing Queens Boulevard when a driver, his name, it turns out, was David Atticielli. And there were a dozen witnesses who reported to the New York Police Department what they saw. They saw a car blocking traffic, but he wouldn't move. And then when she crossed the road, he gunned the car. He just put his foot on the gas, and he killed her. He killed Esther Werdiger, Aryeh Deri's wife's adoptive mother. His mother-in-law, because she wouldn't sign the affidavit. But here's where it gets really, really bad. The driver was employed in New York by Moshe Reich, the co-defendant in the Deri scandals, the same Moshe Reich who handed Deri $100,000 in a bribe. One of his employees ran down Esther Werdiger. And this was murder.
And, of course, whatever happened to the man who was driving the car, was he ever convicted?
Oh, no. The New York Police Department shut that case up. And, by the way, it was used against the Israeli government. It was always put on hold. Always. No. There was heavy-duty politics around this murder. Heavy-duty. And the Americans held this murder against Shas. Now, I could tell you about American ambassador to Tel Aviv, Samuel Lewis, of the CFR, by the way. And that, I have the list in front of me. He's there.
Go ahead.
Going to Rav Yosef, and when Oslo was going slow, and the Moroccan community did not want to sign deals with the PLO, Lewis would show up at Rabbi Ovadia Yosef's home and say, look, this is from the New York Police Department. Deri, it seems, murdered his mother-in-law. And then Shas would just sign away the country. Just simply sign away the country. Because, well, by the way, Deri is not the only one from Shas who was indicted. My lord, there was every Shas member of the Knesset was indicted for theft. But Deri was the sole murderer. Now, here's what happens in 1992, where I get to play a genuine role in this horrible scandal. I write a book. It's called The Fall of Israel. It's a very, very well-received book in England. It was a good publisher, Canongate Publishers, very sophisticated academic left-wing publishing company, very old. I got the lead review in The Economist. You can't knock that. I got every major British paper reviewed this book. I'm talking about the Sunday Telegraph and Scotland on Sunday and the Irish Times and all through the country. They were talking about my book, The Fall of Israel. So when I get back to Israel, I'm invited on, hands down, the leading talk show of the country. Dan Shilon was the name of the host. There were only two channels in Israel. I was told that 85% of the nation's viewers watched me on TV that night. And I want to tell you, they were trying to trap me every which way. Every which way. And I came out of it with pretty good I came out of it beautifully. And this was a reason I could walk down the streets of Israel and people would recognize me. Number one, I brought up Shas, and I brought up Derry. And I tried to bring out that Yossi Beilin blackmailed Derry. I tried every which way, and Dan Shilon, every time I said the word Yossi Beilin, he said, don't use his name on this show, you don't have proof. And I said, I do so have proof. And I said, my proof is Arnon Yekutieli and Shmuel Meir, two deputy mayors of Jerusalem. He said, we don't believe them, don't use Beilin. He just kept cutting me off. And I kept saying that Derry is a vacuum cleaner. I use that word, by the way. I said, whosoever buck, if he goes down, everyone goes down. And in the end, I triumphed on this show. I wasn't the only guest, but I triumphed. And then I get a phone call the next day from a Shas member of Knesset. His name was Bibi, Yigal Bibi. And he invites me to the Knesset to get new information to help my research. So, well, sure, I mean, why not? What the heck? So I go to the Knesset. We have a private room all to ourselves. All to ourselves. I mean, a big, giant room. And he sits me down, and he says, Aryeh, meaning Aryeh Derry, of course. Everyone knows it's Derry. He says, Aryeh is very mad at you. And I said, well, I'm sorry. He said, no, you don't understand. When Aryeh gets mad, he goes crazy. And I said, well, then, you know, I mean, I'm not going to concern myself with that. And he says, you'd better concern yourself with that. He's a very dangerous man, and you have really ticked him off. I sat there getting warnings, which eventually came true. These were death threats. The real thing from member of Knesset, Yigal Bibi was his name, was telling me that Aryeh's going to take care of me if I don't stop these rumors. Now, rumors. You know, high-level rumors, corroborated testimony, the worst I had. And I went to the Knesset, and I was told I better shut my mouth and not go on national TV and not say that Beilin knew all about Derry. I got the full treatment, just like a big shot. Right in the middle of the Knesset, I was told that you are never going to say this again, and I walked out of there, and I kept saying this. It didn't mean a thing to me that I was threatened, but I was right in the heart of the Knesset.
Well, I think it takes a lot of courage to stand in there, but that's what you've done most of your life, isn't it? You've just gone and done what was right rather than what was expedient.
Oh, I don't even know. You know what? Courage is not necessarily me. You won't get me on a roller coaster. But when it comes to these crooks and what they were doing to the country and the fact that Shas signed the Oslo Agreement and joined the Rabin Coalition, and was all because of blackmail. Now, I'm going to mention one more figure why Shas will never leave the government.
Well, whatever happened to Derry? Did he actually get...
Derry went to jail and never came back.
All right, fine. Is he still in prison, or did he die?
No, he did a year and a half. He's been out, let's say, about 3 years, and he's not back in politics. I mean, nobody really wants this con in their party. Who knows what he does behind the scenes, but he's not the Knesset.
All right, fine.
Now, we've covered Chaim Ramon. Remember, he was the one who bribed Derry to be a negotiator way back in 1984 for the sale of the Carmel Bank. And, by the way, we'll do Beilin another time. Beilin was another one of the crooks who was sent by Paris flatter and bribe Derry into the fold, but he's not the government. Actually, you know what? He's not in the government that I'm aware of, but he's certainly supporting the government. That's the Meretz Party. I know they're not the government because the Meretz Party, including Beilin, want Olmert to resign. But nonetheless, Rani Bar-On is in the government, and he is the finance minister. And now this is a bit complicated. There was a committee. It was called the Gidron Committee, and it was investigating a series of bribes surrounding Netanyahu. There were all kinds of bribes, but the big one was the following: that Rani Bar-On and his attorney, Ben Avi, it doesn't matter. They were supplying Derry with information. They tapped phones for Derry. In short, Rani Bar-On cut a deal with Derry.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. All right, go right ahead.
The deal was very, very simple. Netanyahu needed to appease the Shas party to get a government going. Now, Derry, 10 days after the government was in power, Netanyahu was going to withdraw from Hebron. You know, he was obeying his CFR pals, and 10 days later, he's going to withdraw from Hebron. What Derry told Bar-On was very simple. If he didn't get his way, his Shas party would vote against the withdrawal from Hebron, and in doing so, probably bring down the government after 10 days. Now, and here's what Derry asked for. He asked that Netanyahu appoint Rani Bar-On his state attorney general. There was a reason for this, and it's a terrible crime reason, and it's drug smuggling, and it's Belgium, and it's so complicated that really we need a separate show for this. But the point was that Bar-On agreed to a plea bargain for Derry. Instead of going on trial for fraud and embezzlement, he would just do a plea bargain and enter the government and not go to jail. And because of this, well, Netanyahu appointed Rani Bar-On, as his attorney general. Now, he was a nothing. I want you to know he was just a crooked nothing. But nonetheless, Netanyahu appointed him, and then there was the Gidron Commission to find out why, and lo and behold, what do we discover? That Rani Bar-On is now he is today's finance minister. In the crooked Kadima government, he is finance minister. Now, this was such a complicated story, I'm not going to go farther. Someday I will, if you give me the opportunity. It is a terrible story. Well, murder is pretty good, but it gets worse. It gets into very, very heavy money laundering in a way you can't imagine.
And, well, we're out of time, but I think it's important that people understand that there's total corruption in the Israeli government. But if you don't think there's corruption in our government, with billions of dollars are disappearing all the time over there in Iraq, and of course, all sorts of, you know, non-bid contracts given to Dick Cheney's friends. You know, Israel doesn't have a monopoly on corruption. Our guest has been Barry Shammas.
Well, now you know why Shas won't leave the government.
All right. Good night. And God bless you, Barry.
We'll
talk to you.
Bye. Right.
And we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind all of our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And, of course, if you listen to Barry, you understand why Shatz, which is a political party, will not leave the government and bring it down so they get rid of Olmert before he gives away all of Israel and betrays the Israeli people. Well, anyway, of course, if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. How do we understand what's going on today in Israel? What's going on today in the United States? Well, there are powerful spiritual forces working behind the secret societies that are working behind the scenes. You probably heard about the Council on Foreign Relations, but you've never heard about the secret society that the Council on Foreign Relations is simply a front organization for. How can I make that statement? Well, Bill Clinton's mentor, a professor who taught at Harvard and Princeton and certainly then went to Georgetown University, who is acknowledged by some of the leading historians today. Professor Quigley was probably one of the leading historians of the 20th century. And in his book, Tragedy and Hope, The History of the World in Our Time, which was actively suppressed, in fact, somebody bought up the publisher, Macmillan, and destroyed the place in the first half of the book so it couldn't be reprinted. And if you doubt that story, we have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells the very story I'm telling you. And I confirm this, of course, talking to Professor Quigley's wife and his best friend when I was back there about 1980, going through Professor Quigley's papers. And we read all of Professor Quigley's papers and spent weeks going through them before they could be sanitized, because this is what they ordinarily do. They have somebody go in and simply remove the most important papers, but we got there before they had a chance to do it. Because, of course, they don't have that many people on their side. And I was just fortunate to have the time and the ability to close down my medical practice and go through Professor Quigley's papers. But if you get his book, which we have now, it's been put back into print, on pages 951 and 952, it tells about the origin of the Council on Foreign Relations and the fact that the Council was organized in 1921 as a front for the very small American Round Table and for J.P. Morgan. And, of course, the American Round Table tied into the British Round Table, which was a front for a group known as the Association of Helpers, which was a front for the secret society that Cecil Rhodes created back in 1891. And the purpose of this organization was to bring about a world government, to gain control of the wealth of the world and the media of the world. And this is all covered in another book Professor Quigley wrote called The Anglo-American Establishment, which was also actually suppressed and could not be printed until after Professor Quigley had died. Well, understand that behind, of course, these secret societies are powerful spiritual forces. And this is, of course, what Professor Quigley and most people who have written about the Council on Foreign Relations have totally missed. And that is that down through the ages, there have been secret societies for thousands of years. And what was their goal? Why, to bring democracy to the world, to bring about a one-world government, a one-world religion, and certainly a one-world leader. And, of course, that one-world leader will be Lucifer. And this is an age-old plan, but what's so amazing is it's coming to fruition today. And what I've just told you has been kept secret for thousands of years, and yet now much of this is being popularized in a book called The Secret by Rhonda Byrne, that wants to get you and everybody they can to get in touch with this secret power that's out there. What's the secret power? Why, it's the power of Lucifer, of course, but they're not going to tell you that. They're going to tell you what the serpent said in the Garden of Eden. And if you read the book The Secret by Rhonda Byrne or listen to her DVD, they'll tell you. You see, the secret is you are God. Well, of course, I don't believe I'm God. I don't think I'll ever be a God. My job is to fear God and keep His commandments. But they're leading an awful lot of people astray, leading an awful lot of people to tap into the secret power out there. And, of course, they'll pay for it with their eternal souls. Our number, 1-800-544-8927.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.